que nous descendons du nord, pas ouais. Dépendant d'ailleurs.
They chained us like animals. They chained our feet, hands, and waist. Once we arrived, they made us stay on the plane until they unchained us, so the journalists wouldn't see what they did. We were completely chained up. They chained us with chains.
And they deserve that hearing. They deserve due process. They deserve asylum. They deserve refuge.
Horrific images of the United States Border Patrol on horseback violently attacking black immigrants as they attempted to flee for their lives went viral and caused outrage throughout the country.
They are there because the U.S. was in Haiti and these other places, right? They are here because our government is there, and that's the reality.
In this program, we look at the system of white supremacy that perpetuates and profits from the crises in Haiti.
The conditions are horrible. We're going to need some mental health counselors to help people get through the drama, because these children have been traumatized, I'm sure.
And grassroots community organizations step up to the plate yet again to help asylum seekers. From Pacifica Radio, this is COVID, Race, and Democracy, a collective effort by producers from Pacifica stations and radio affiliates. I'm your host, Akua Holt. Attorney Nana Jumpy, Executive Director of the Black Alliance for Just Immigration, or BAJI, explains the history of racist U.S. immigration deportation policies toward Black immigrants. With Pacifica's Andre Imani Ward, co-host of On the Count, the Prison and Criminal Justice Report, from Pacifica Radio WBAI in New York.
Can you give our listening audience just some historical context and what has led up to where our Haitian brothers and sisters are today in Texas? Why are they there?
You know, when we look at what's happening in Del Rio, Texas, firstly, you know, got to point out that this is something that's happening all along the border, that this is not something that's just limited to that one area. This is an inflection point in terms of what's happened there in Del Rio, but certainly is not something new, unfortunately, for Haitian asylum seekers or other Black asylum seekers that are also in the area coming towards the border or at the border. Important to bring up, because we're hearing reports now that there are Cameroonians, for example, who were also deported to Haiti that are, you know, don't come from Haiti, know nothing about Haiti, and yet they've been deported there. But there's a special way in which the United States has targeted Haitian asylum seekers in particular that is, you know, decades and decades old. So we know, for example, many of us that, you know, that are old as dirt and twice as funky as myself, about what happened with the difference between the Haitians and the Cubans, where Cubans, as long as they could make it to the United States, were received, had a special program that allowed them to get green cards. And Haitians, on the other hand, were turned back, which is, you know, what we see happening now, without any effort or opportunity to be able to even make asylum claims, which is unlawful. But the first country to have to deal with that was Haiti back then. You had Guantanamo Bay. The first people held in Guantanamo Bay are not the people after that were rounded up and persecuted after 9/11, but were in fact Haitians who were seeking asylum to come to the United States. And we hear rumblings once again about Guantanamo Bay seeking folks who speak Spanish and Haitian Creole to work as guards there. And then we have the history of, you know, this focus on Haitian migrants to keep Haitian migrants in particular from being able to come into this country. And it, we can't help but do the contrast, for example, with Afghanistan and the way in which this country has already indicated that it will be receiving and accepting 90,000 refugees from Afghanistan. We don't, you know, we don't begrudge them that, but the, you know, you're turning away 15,000 in Del Rio in such a violent and traumatic way when you're open to folks from Afghanistan, and in fact have increased the cap of refugees the United States will take to 165,000, but you can't take in tens of thousands of Haitian asylum seekers and other Black asylum seekers. We see the disparate treatment that is meted out based upon Blackness, which I know we'll talk more about later. But in terms of Haiti, this special relationship or the special way in which the United States state power meets what they consider to be the unforgivable Blackness of Haiti is one that we do have to highlight.
And that unforgivable Blackness of Haiti has its root tracing all the way back to Toussaint L'Ouverture's overthrowing of the French, right? And the complete dissatisfaction historically, right, that's impacting Haiti today because of that revolution that Toussaint L'Ouverture waged and was ultimately victorious. And people have never, ever forgotten that. And I think years and centuries, Haiti has been suffering as a result. Is that true? Is that correct?
That's absolutely correct. And I want to add to that. When Haiti freed itself, right, in a way that shocked the world, when Haiti freed itself, it didn't just free itself. It provided refuge for Africans that were enslaved and escaped from the United States of America. It made the effort to try to help enslaved Africans in the other part of the island, now known as Dominican Republic, to free themselves. It became a rallying cry in the United States, amongst the so-called free and enslaved African people. Remember, Santo Domingo was what they called Haiti at that time. So Haiti served as material support for Black folks being, yearning to be free and fighting to be free, served as spiritual support, emotional support. And that's that unforgivable Blackness. Haiti didn't just do it for itself. But the fact that Haiti and the Black people of Haiti did it for the world, and particularly the Black world, is what makes that Blackness so unforgivable. Because if they had just done it for themselves, it would still be terrible. But the fact that they spread that is what made it so really terrible.
Right. And so now, talking about what's happening in Texas, right, there's also some context, right? It's not like just our brothers and sisters from Haiti have just migrated from Haiti to the United States, particularly in this region in Texas, without context, right? There, some things have happened in Haiti fairly recently that has contributed to that. Talk a little bit about that, Nana, right? I know that one of the leaders was murdered, some other things that's happened recently in Haiti that has also contributed to the migration. Talk a little bit about that.
Absolutely. I'm going to encourage folks to read the letter from the special envoy to the United States, Daniel Foote, who resigned, and in his resignation letter on his way out, really laid out some of the pieces happening within Haiti that in terms of the influence of the United States that I think is really, or intervention really of the United States, which I think is really important. And so you have a situation in which, number one, you have this U.S. imperialism really being played out in Haiti such that they've never been able to have a political stability. And whenever they've had anything close to political stability, the United States has made sure to create a situation where that is not the case, so they can continue with their allies to exploit Haiti. And so there is the recent assassination of the president of Haiti, whom, some of the folks in Haiti, Haitians themselves were not pleased with, but certainly did not want to have assassinated. And I think it has to be noted that amongst those folks who engaged in the assassination that they've arrested so far that are English speaking, that they are connected to the United States, connected to the DEA. And so we know that the United States is involved in some way in that assassination. We also look at the earthquake that happened, the 7.3 magnitude earthquake that recently happened that devastated a country that already was not, rebuilt from the earthquake even that occurred in 2010 and earthquakes that have happened in between this time period. significant because of the why the earthquakes are happening, based upon all of the mining and other resource exploitation that's going on in Haiti. Again, not something that Haitians are doing to themselves, not like they're cursed. This is things that, you know, ways in which imperialism of the West is impacting their world. And so they're leaving and going through South America, through Central America, in the effort to seek asylum in the United States, traveling thousands of miles, sometimes, you know, across 8 to 10 borders, in order to get to the northern border of Mexico, southern border of the United States, only to be stopped, not because of the law, because the law says they should be able to claim asylum without any problem. No one should be holding them anywhere. They're stopped because of U.S. domestic policy in terms of immigration policy, and they're stopped because of the pressure that the U.S. has put on other countries from Colombia to Mexico through its foreign policy, requiring those countries to also stop the Haitians and bottleneck and other Black asylum seekers and bottleneck them so that you have 18,000 and 15,000 in locations as you see today.
Can you speak to Levat a little bit around the migrant detention that's happening and the impact that's having on our Haitian brothers and sisters? And lastly, what are some of the things that could be done, right, to ensure that our Haitian brothers and sisters in Texas are protected, right? They're supported, et cetera.
So we know that our folks who are being detained, right now they're detaining them for two purposes, either to process them, which is probably the minority. The majority, their detentions are just so that they can set them up to be expelled again without the opportunity to give to make their asylum claims. And we know that Haitian asylum seekers, other Black migrants, are particularly targeted for detention and deportation. There is a group of Haitian migrants right now that are doing a hunger strike in detention in Florida, based upon the deplorable conditions that they are forced to live in. And we know about the conditions of confinement, right? Detention, caging in any way is torture. And so our Haitian siblings and other Black migrants are being tortured right now in percentages that are way higher than any other migrant populations of any other races. And that's important to speak to. And so what we need is we need folks to apply the pressure. We need you to look out for actions that are going to be happening across the country and to join those actions, demanding the end to the detention and deportation, not just of Haitian migrants, but Black migrants generally, because we're all being attacked in the same ways. And then also to ask for humanitarian parole, making sure that all Black asylum seekers can come into this country and not have to continue to deal in Mexico with all of the anti-Blackness that they're dealing with, including anti-Black violence. And then we're also calling for the end of Title 42. This policy, which we understood was racist under Donald Trump, has suddenly become not racist under President Biden. We know that's a lie. And so the Title 42 needs to end. Those are the three main pieces that we are lifting up, as well as of course, people should be pushing for the investigation into what happened at Del Rio, because this is not arbitrary. This is part of the systemic violence of this system, and we need to expose it, and we need to eliminate it as we work towards a world without cops, without cages.
Attorney Nana Jumpy is the executive director of the Black Alliance for Just Immigration, BAJI, and a frequent contributor and host of this show. BAJI educates and engages African American and Black immigrant communities to organize and advocate for racial, social, and economic justice. Visit their website at www.baji.org. We thank Andre Imani Ward, co-host of On the Count, the Prison and Criminal Justice Report from Pacifica Radio WBAI, New York.
Upload the evolution principle. We see a rock on the shore and say it's always been there. Download, no responsibility. Do what you want, no. nobody cares. But lo, the master race idea, genetically disposed to rule the world. Down low, a future full of isolated, full of isolated boys and girls. Upload a two-party system. The lesser of two dangers, illusion of choice. Download a bare form of fascism.
That was Colonized Mind by Prince. You are listening to Pacifica's COVID Race and Democracy. I'm Akua Holt. Supporters of the Haitian community rallied in San Francisco to demand freedom for the refugees and for the U.S. to leave Haiti.
The U.S. out of Haiti!
Haiti will be free!
Black lives matter!
From Haiti to Haiti!
Because our brothers and sisters who are being deported to Haiti are freedom fighters. These are people who've been repressed by the government of Haiti, by the occupation forces that are in Haiti. Haiti has been under the United Nations occupation ever since 2004. And that occupation was what triggered it. It was triggered by the coup d'etat, the kidnapping coup d'etat against the popularly elected government of President Aristide. Following this coup d'etat kidnapping, massacres were taking place.
Many of these massacres were conducted by the occupation forces, by UN forces. And why were they being conducted? Because our brothers and sisters who had voted for the government of President Aristide, the government that was providing them with healthcare, with schools, with clean drinking water, with support for local food production by our farmers, which for the first time since the days of the founding of Haiti, made the Haitian people proud to be Haitians again. People were going back home to Haiti, those who had fled the Duvalier years were going back home to Haiti. And then this coup d'etat took place, driving away people. It's been close to 18 years since that coup, but the coup continues because there is an occupation led by the U.S. friends, Canada, and with Brazil being in charge of the troops that have been massacring people in neighborhoods like Cité Soleil and Bel Air and a number of communities. We are talking from 2004 and continuing to the present. The Haitian police is trained, and I hope, and we are right here, so this is in front of the federal building, because we need to condemn the federal government of the U.S. for their policies, whether it's Democrats or Republicans. It's been an ongoing policy of repression in Haiti, of subjugation of our people, of exploitation of our people, and this must stop. These are brothers and sisters on the border there. They had to flee from the repression. Many of them, their homes were destroyed. Right now, what's going on in Haiti is that the Haitian police is one of the most repressive forces in Haiti. They were trained by U.S. police. They were trained by Canadian police. They are trained by other troops from the United Nations, but mostly U.S. and Canadian. And these are very brutal forces. And what they have done, you see, when the people movement took power, they got rid of the Haitian military. They got rid of the Tonton Macoutes, Duvalier's secret police. But what this occupation has done, it has re-emerged. It has resurrected the Tonton Macoutes. But they are very slick. They are very slick in the way they do it. They call them gangs. When they call them gangs, the media call them gangs, that means people think that they are not connected with the Haitian government. You see? And that's the trick. Because all over Haiti, everybody talks about the connections, how these guys are financed, the weapons they get. Now, think about it. Haiti doesn't produce any AK-47. Haiti doesn't produce any Galils. Haiti doesn't produce any kind of M-30 or all those big caliber guns. And the young brothers and sisters who are part of those so-called gangs but who are really death squads, they can't even afford a meal. They can't even afford to eat one meal per day, yet they have bullets galore and they are shooting those guns all over the place. And they are burning down houses. And in the countryside, people are being displaced. Their homes, their lands are being taken over. This is what's going on. This is what's happening. And this is what our brothers and sisters are fleeing from. And so, ever since 2010, many of them have gone to Brazil, some to Chile, where their labor has been super exploited. And when they are done exploiting their labor, then now they are pushing them out. And where do they go? They go wherever they can. As free human beings, they have to find life somewhere. And then they end up on the border where they are being mistreated and killed and criminalized. This is Haitian government, the Haitian occupation government, encouraged the people to leave because they were making money off of the trip. You see? And when the people got there to those countries, to Brazil and Chile and others, their labor is exploited. And keep in mind that Brazil and Chile are part of the occupation forces in Haiti too. But understand one thing, they are refugees and they are seeking asylum in this country and in other countries. They deserve respect, they have rights. There are international laws that protect people who are seeking refuge, and they deserve that hearing. They deserve due process. They deserve asylum. They deserve refuge.
This is a multi-generational controlled program of assault and oppression on the self-determination of the people of the Republic of Haiti.
U.S. out of Haiti! Haiti will be free!
Music by Nago, traditional Haitian drum ensemble. The history of Haiti's self-determination as a sovereign African-Caribbean nation, including the French-American and Canadian oppressors, must be examined to understand what we witness in plain sight under the Del Rio Bridge at the border of Texas and Mexico. Congresswoman Maxine Waters responded at a press conference last week, stating the U.S. Border Patrol's brutal treatment of Haitian citizens was worse than what was done to enslaved Africans in the U.S.
I'm pissed. I'm unhappy, and I'm not just unhappy with the cowboys who were running down Haitians and using their reins to whip them. I'm happy with the administration. We are following the Trump policy. He is the one that does not follow the Constitution and would not allow those seeking refuge to be able to petition to get into the country. What the hell are we doing here? What we witness takes us back hundreds of years. What we witnessed was worse than what we witnessed in slavery. Cowboys with their reins again, whipping black people, Haitians, into the water where they're scrambling and falling down when all they're trying to do is escape from violence in their country. Yes, it is unfortunate that it is the poorest country in this hemisphere. It is unfortunate that they have no stable government right now. It is unfortunate that they've had to live through earthquakes. I've been working with Haitians for 30 years. I've been working through two coups d'etats. I went to the Central African Republic and I brought back Aristide after he was exiled into the Central African Republic. They have always been between Canada and France and the United States treated worse than anybody else. And so, yes, we are here and we are organized and we're saying to the president and everybody else, you got to stop this madness. And I want to know, in the first place, who's paying these cowboys to do this work? They've got to be gotten rid of. They've gotten to be stopped. It cannot go on. And so I thank all of you for being here today. Write the story. Tell the story about what is going on. And let people know that they're trying to take us back to slavery days and worse than that.
Congresswoman Waters' statement comes at a time when the Biden administration has deported more than 2,000 Haitians since last week, out of more than 12,000 that have been apprehended at the Texas-Mexico border. Another 3,900 Haitians are in government custody and will be deported or put into removal proceedings, according to the New York Times. Jemima Pierre is the Haitian America's coordinator for the Black Alliance for Peace and professor of Black Studies and Anthropology at the University of California, Los Angeles. In a conversation with host of On the Ground, Esther Iverum of WPFW, Washington, D.C., Dr. Pierre talked about the border crises as a direct result of U.S. intervention and the dismantling of the Haitian state by the U.S. and European neocolonial elites with the support of both political parties.
As I looked at the images and the coverage this week, I grew increasingly concerned that the issue of what is happening to Haitians here will be confined to this one image of this border agent, you know, whipping at this man seeking asylum here, and that this image and representation will become more important than the policy of how Haitians are treated in the U.S. and in Haiti. What's your take?
Well, we're on the same page because there are two things happening. Part of it is the spectacle of it has become more about the representation of it, you're absolutely right, than about actual structural policies and U.S. policies in the region. And the second thing that it does, and I'm Haitian, right? And so I very much feel the pain of seeing this. But what it does is completely erase all the other Black immigrants that have been stuck at the U.S.-Mexico borders for years. So you have Black immigrants from the African continent, from Colombia, from Nicaragua, from Venezuela, all stuck at the borders. And you also, we can't forget our brown brothers and sisters who have also borne the brunt of U.S. immigration, terrible policies and treatment. And so the other thing that it does is also allows us not to talk about what led to the almost 15,000 Haitians at the Texas-Mexico border. But also, there are actually more people stuck at the southern Mexico border with Guatemala and in Tijuana. But it also allows us not to talk about the fact that why there is a buildup. You know, it's not like these Haitians just showed up from out of nowhere. It's not like they just swam from Haiti and ended up in Texas. They've been there for years, and they've been there for years precisely because beginning with Obama in early 2016, there was this process that U.S. Border Patrol and U.S. immigration started called metering, which meant that it drastically cut the number of asylum seekers that could actually come to the border and seek asylum. And what they would do is hand out numbers and give them appointments where they can come and claim asylum. And sometimes these appointments would be, you know, 2-3 weeks out, 2-3 months out. And now it's years before you can even come and claim asylum. And so Obama's administration started doing that. And then Trump then, of course, upped the ante. And what he did was do his remain in Mexico policy,
right,
which then forces everyone to actually stay in Mexico while they wait for their case to go through the courts, which can take years. So you have this buildup beginning really 5 years ago as the numbers are growing. You have the buildup. And so that's the reason why there's so many people there. You know, these people are not from Mexico, including our brown brothers and sisters who are stuck in Mexico. They're not from Mexico. So people are living in terrible conditions because of U.S. policy. And then U.S. policy with complicity of the Mexican government of mistreating everybody. So now you have the southern border that has thousands, you know, more people than the Texas border, the southern border in Guatemala. You have 20, 30,000 people waiting. And the Mexican government, using the Mexican military, are basically really terrorizing the people down there, trying to prevent them from coming up to the border to ask for asylum, right? And so you have all that.
Now, when you say that, just for clarification, at that southern border, are they keeping them in Guatemala from coming into Mexico, or they are allowed into Mexico, but they aren't allowed to migrate up through the country?
It's both, right? Okay. So it's both. And then there's a small town, I forgot the name of it, and I need to look this up, but there's a small town in Mexico where a lot of these migrants have been camped out in the main plaza for weeks and now months, right? Where the Mexican government is blocking them from leaving and heading north Before, the Mexican government used to let them head north and claim asylum, and sometimes would give some of them regularization papers to allow them the transit, because they need papers from the Mexican government to transit up north to the U.S.-Mexico border. So you have that. So there are immigrants at multiple points in the Americas. There's also a group of immigrants stuck in Colombia at the border, right? Because the U.S. border, we have to think about, is not just the U.S.-Mexico border. It's being enforced everywhere. It's the Colombia border. It's the Guatemala-Mexican border, because the U.S. is enforcing that, forcing or working in tandem with these other nations to prevent the migration north.
This week, I was listening to a real activist and, you know, advocacy around immigration issues who talked about how so many Haitian workers went to Brazil to work on construction of the Olympics in Rio in 2016, because you mentioned 2016. So I thought, wow, you know, we have a lot of things converging on that year. So, and that after things were built, they were basically told, okay, well, we don't need you anymore. And these people started the migration north, up through Central America, to Mexico, to the areas that we're talking about right now. And then also, there are the people who left Haiti after the earthquake. So what can you tell us about those two, I guess, groups of migrants who have maybe come to this place now after so many, you know, years of not even living in Haiti?
Well, exactly. And this is the other point I was going to make. You know, the spectacle of the Texas-Mexico border gets everybody upset, but no one's upset at the ongoing U.S. destabilization and completely dismantling of the Haitian state from the 2004 coup d'etat, which the U.S., Canada, and France sponsored. Why are there Haitians in Brazil? Well, Haitians are in Brazil because after the coup d'etat in 2004, the U.S. came in with an occupation force, and then the U.N. took over from that with this so-called peacekeeping force, with Brazil, so-called leftist government Lula, leading the military wing of the occupation, which is why Brazil then became a space for Haiti to go to after the earthquake, which is why Brazil found Haitians as cheap labor. So Haiti was a training ground for Brazil and its soldiers so that they can go back and terrify the Black people in the favelas. Wow. And so part of that, we have to think about, this is a story, this is a crisis of imperialism. The reason that there are Haitians in Brazil is because Brazil participated in the ongoing occupation of Haiti through the UN and the so-called core group, which makes a lot of the decisions in Haiti, and the U.S. government. So these people are there. And then you're absolutely right. The fact that the Brazil government became right-wing, neoliberal policies, the demise of the Brazilian economy, and racism, really made people leave and flee and head to a place where they had family and so on. And so that's really why these people are there. They are there because the U.S. was in Haiti and these other places, right? They are here because our government is there. And that's the reality. Understand that it's U.S. imperialism that is the crisis of Haiti. And it's Western imperialism. And it's also part of the reason, the reality is that Haiti has never really stopped suffering for actually having a revolution against white supremacy.
Professor Jemima Pierre is the Haitian Americas coordinator for the Black Alliance for Peace and professor of Black Studies and Anthropology at the University of California, Los Angeles. Many thanks to producer and host of On the Ground, Esther Iverum, of Pacifica's WPFW in the nation's capital, Washington, D.C. You can find their full conversation at onthegroundshow.org. Samba, samba, malo. Samba, samba, malo. Whoa.
sapote
maule
shala luo ma sapote
maule
music by Bookman Experience. As some wait for Congress and the Biden administration to respond, activists are on the ground helping asylum seekers. Cleo Glenn Johnson McLaughlin is the president of the Black United Fund of Texas and co-chair of the American Caribbean Chamber of Commerce. They have been providing services, securing donations, food, medicine, clothing, and shelter, as well as connecting our Haitian sisters and brothers to their families throughout the country.
We started looking at all the things that were happening as it related to the people. They were coming here basically from a country that had already been devastated. They left there with nothing. They still have nothing. And so with people on the road for 3 months trying to get to freedom, and they had nothing other than what they had on their backs and in whatever bags that they had. We had to respond to the needs of the people because they were devastated before they left, and they became even more devastated after they started moving on. There was nothing else for us to do but to start trying to accumulate items that they would need, toiletries, clothes, locations for them to be able to stay if possible. The people are not coming just to stay in Houston. What they're hoping to do is to move on to where their family members are. We're trying to help with that. We're doing a lot, various things, actually, that we're doing. We're collecting food where, yes, money is necessary because we have to help those who do not have funding. We don't know how many children are in any one family that must be moved to another city or another state. We're trying to make sure that we have enough funds that we can help the people, whether it's by bus or by plane, to help their family members get them. Because the only way that they can stay here, they have to have a sponsor. Now, some of the people who will not have family members sponsoring them or being responsible for them, the Black United Fund of Texas and the American Caribbean Chamber of Commerce ends up being one of their sponsors so that we can try to help them become stabilized, become legal, so they can deal with any type of issues that may come about.
The perception from the public is most of the people were deported. You're saying that there are a number of people that were allowed to stay based on the fact that they have family members in the United States. Do you know if the folks that are here, will they be seeking asylum?
Yes, they are. They are seeking asylum. We have immigration lawyers lined up to help all of them. Right now, we have about, 2,500 here. We got 2,500 in San Antonio. There is a church that came in and got quite a few people here, maybe about 200 people, because that church had members that were Haitians, and they identified their family members and came here and picked people up. So there are people being moved constantly. But yes, we do have about 1,200 people who are seeking asylum here in the U.S., and we are providing immigration lawyers to assist with them. The beautiful part about it, Mark Esters, an attorney here in Houston, has stepped up to the plate and said, I've organized a team of lawyers who's willing to help them on all fronts to get their lives in order. We also have the Black realtors working with us to locate properties that might be available for a minimal cost, hopefully no cost, but for the most part, we know that we may end up having to pay for something, but they're trying to help us locate some places for people to stay until they're able to move on. We're looking at probably 90 days. We'll know more about who's going to be here and who's going to be leaving.
Can you tell us, Cleo, what condition did you find the people in? We've received reports that many people, some were, ill from the long track, from the long journey, that some were attacked coming through the various countries. Some mothers were pregnant and were exhausted. How is the health condition of our people? And we're also received reports that many of them have been tested or not for corona.
let me just say this. The conditions, yes, are deplorable. It's not easy for them because here again, there's no medical care until they get here. Now, where the people are here in Houston in this makeshift shelter, they are providing them with health care and testing and all sorts of services, computers and phones to contact loved ones. And of course, showers, clean clothes, and people are being treated. The worst that things that did happen was, yes, people were abused. People were, women were raped. There's no structure. There was no guidance. You know, the people showed up just, you know, we're dealing with earthquake one day. And then all of a sudden, did you hear? We got 20,000 Haitians on the Texas border, along with other people. But here again, a large number of people were, in fact, the conditions are horrible. We're going to need some mental health counselors to help people get through the drama because these children have been traumatized, I'm sure. They don't know, you know, whether or not they're going to be able to hang on to their parents or they're going to be separated from their parents. But for the most part, that has not truly happened yet. The families have stayed together for the most part. So we're trying to provide them with everything that they need because they need everything that is possible to help them get their lives back, not just going forward, but right now. We need everything to help them.
You're listening to Cleo Glenn Johnson McLaughlin, president of the Black United Fund of Texas. She is also co-chair of the American Caribbean Chamber of Commerce. Giving us an update, a bird's eye view of what's happening to our brothers and sisters who were first detained from Haiti, prevented from entering the country seeking asylum. And now some of them have been placed in various shelters in Texas and southern states. Tell us how people can assist.
They can, in fact, donate monetarily. Go to our website, www.buftx.org/donate to Haiti. Here's the other way that they can help. By helping the elected officials in their area, regardless to where they are in this country, they need to start writing these people and telling them what they expect them to do as elected officials. The silence is not helping us. And we need to know that they're paying attention to the pain and the drama and the things that have been caused, not by the people. Haiti is not in the condition that it's in because of the people. The people are productive people. They want a lifestyle as good and as anyone else, but it's been outside influences that have caused the demise of Haiti, not the people. Haiti is a country that is beautiful and have beautiful people, but yet we have allowed them to become victims of a game that they could not afford to play. They would just write their elected officials, their city, their state, and their congressional people, including the president and the VP. Write them, tell them what you want them to do because you elected these people to be in office, have them work for you. And when you have them working for you, you have them work changing things and making things better.
Cleo Glenn Johnson McLaughlin, president of the Black United Fund of Texas and co-chair of the American Caribbean Chamber of Commerce. She's the mother of Texas State Representative Jarvis Johnson and former assistant to the late Congressman Mickey Leland. To support Haiti relief efforts, visit the Black United Fund of Texas online at bufftx.org. In the final minutes of this program, we turn to New Orleans, where transit workers are facing the latest hurricane and electricity outage. On top of the ongoing lack of personal protective equipment amidst the pandemic, the management of the New Orleans Regional Transit Authority not only refused to pay hurricane hazard pay to the workers, but also fired the president of the Amalgamated Transit Union, Local 1560, Ms. Valerie Jefferson. They also said they would not recognize her as the union president. COVID Race and Democracy producer Steve Zeltzer spoke to Valerie Jefferson.
What are the conditions that transit workers in New Orleans faced with that hurricane?
People don't realize that we humans too. We have the same needs and we go through the same thing like everybody else. We had operators, including myself, was working at standby. Our houses was flooded, was damaged, heavily damaged, hole in the ceiling. The foundation of the house moved. We had trees fell on our houses, a lot of debris. We was in the dark. We can, some areas we come in, was come to our house because there was a lot of debris and a lot of wires hanging down. We was in a fix. When I say we was in a fix, we was in a fix. And we was in the dark and we had no lights, no AC. We was suffering from everything else, just like everybody else. We was looking for food, water, but RTA had need us. RTA was very short of operators. They had between, I don't know, 50 or 80 operators. They were very short because the city was asking for 100 and more operators, like 100 operators. And that was with the streetcars, the paratransit, and the bus. And also, they in need of clerks, dispatchers, supervisors. They were very short. And the RTA asked the union to help them out to get some operators. And Alex said, it doesn't matter the money. It doesn't mean about the money. Don't worry about the money. Get the operators here. We need operators. Then I was telling them that the operators in the fix too, but we still reach out to the operators and they sacrifice. They sacrifice their livelihood. They sacrifice their family. They forsake what they need to be doing. They should have been taking care of their family, taking care of themselves, taking care of their house because they was in the dark. Then when the operators still sacrificed and came for the needs of the city, for the need of our TA asking them, we were staying in the dark at the hotel. It was heat. It was very hot. We stayed in the lounge, slept on the floor, slept in our car, slept in the garage, slept on a pool table, on a couch. We forsake our needs for the sake of the company and for the sake mostly for the city citizens of New Orleans. Because RTA needed us for cooling stations. This is the first time we ever did this. They used the buses for cooling station all over the city. They had placed them all over the city, in front of the nursing home, in front of the elderly homes, the retirement homes, and that's everywhere in the city for everybody can come and sit and be out of the heat and plug up their phones, drink some water, and we was there for the need of the city. One operator family left because she had to stay. She said, no, I got to stay. She sacrificed herself and her family left out, but guess what? She didn't even send her way to work. She had to catch Uber or somebody had to go pick her up to get to the station.
Yes. There was no gas.
And that's there was right. No gas. The electricity
no gas
was out.
For the cars.
This is a real catastrophe. So that you know, have no electricity and they're calling on the bus drivers to abandon their families, abandon saving their homes, which are flooded, like you were saying, and to go and drive these buses to help other people. And nursing homes, the other people as cooling stations. And what did they promise you, that you would be compensated for this, or did they want you to work for free?
No, they promised us that we were going to get paid for this. Matter of fact, we have a signed document that we was going to pay for this. Everybody's on standby, including the dispatchers, the clerks, because the dispatchers and the clerks are our helpmate. The operators can't do it by ourselves. So we had the supervisors, the clerks and the dispatcher, all of us was all together. And they had agreed to pay us, the ones who were on standby, to pay us our regular run, just like we was at work a regular day, 12-hour shift, because we were working 12-hour shift from 6 to 6, and plus 10 hours of a sentence pay, something like a sentence pay for coming in sacrifices. Then at the same time, RTA plus will supply us with a room and board and with food, lunch, dinner, and breakfast. But it didn't happen like that, Steve. We got fed prison food, and it was given to us like it was not given to us in a respectful manner. Well, I'm not talking about the prison food. Food is food, but the way you present it, it was very poorly presented to us. And I brought it to Alex's attention. He said that they're trying their best. So at the end, the last couple of days, they did approve on a dinner, but all operators didn't get fed. The ones who was out there on the bus from 6 to 6, a couple of them got left out, and we don't have no way to get food. We don't have no way to get water. So they was very hungry until the end of the day.
Did this Alex Wiggins, was he aware of the kind of treatment you were getting, or lack
yes.
of respect?
I told him myself. I told him what was going on. Then the leadership team that was there with me was on standby. We had a meeting with him. We kept him updated. We told him what was going on. And plus, he had a meeting with his staff that morning. Every morning and every afternoon, every evening, they had a meeting. So he was very aware of what was going on. See, I was there every day from August the 28th until they fired me. I was there with everybody just like everybody else, because no one is not going to mistreat Local 1560 without me being there. I like being there with my members.
Why did they fire you? Why did he fire you? What was the reason he gave for firing you?
Well, he gave the reason that I was workplace violence. I said, made a statement that was threatening to him. He said that I said, from his perspective, I said, it's on now, B. I do not use profanity. I can say what I mean and mean what I say without using profanity. And plus, if I was threatened, I was walking away from him when I did say, it's on now. I got to call the leadership. We got to set a meeting. I need to contact my executive board. That's what I said. And we was like, we was further than 20 feet apart then, because I was exiting the door. I was going out the door. I wasn't nearby near him. So he fired me, terminated me for violence at the workplace.
So you were terminated for violence at the workplace because you were actually standing up for yourself and your fellow members on the job.
Correct. Because when they terminated the COO, that's who did the negotiation. That's who the union mostly did our 90% of meetings and negotiation with. So if you terminate this person, the next person, who we going to have a meeting with? So we already had like verbal agreements. We had statements that we were going to do for in the near future for the betterment of the workplace environment. That's out the window. We're going to have quarterly meetings, events. I want to say workplace positively, things to do with the membership and with all the employees. Now that's out the door. And we're supposed to be going in a new direction for positive, for we can be productive. That's out the door.
The Amalgamated Transit Union is the largest labor union representing transit and allied workers in the U.S. and Canada. We just heard from ATU Local 1560 Union President Valerie Jefferson in New Orleans, in conversation with Pacifica producer Steve Zeltzer.
A poet, a prophet, a king, would you harbor an exile or a refugee, a person living with AIDS? Would you harbor a Tubman, a Garrett, a Truth, a fugitive or a slave? Would you harbor a Haitian, Korean or Czech, a lesbian or a gay?
Sweet Honey in the Rock, Will You Harbor Me? I'd like to take a moment to acknowledge three extraordinary and fearless African-American women who have passed on. Each lived in Haiti at some point in their lives to serve the people. Ms. Catherine Dunham, anthropologist, choreographer, and humanitarian, went on a hunger strike at age 82 in East St. Louis, Illinois, to protest the treatment of Haitian refugees by the United States government and the ouster of President Aristide. Maria Duperval, Valerie Michel, who founded Haitian American Ministries to deliver aid to families in need. And lastly, Dr. Edith Irby Jones. She established a health clinic in Haiti. We thank them for their work at a time when the rest of the world, including the media, ignored the struggles of Haiti and the impact of anti-Black international policy by European countries, including the United States. That concludes today's edition of COVID, Race, and Democracy. We thank all Pacifica sister stations and its radio affiliates who contributed to the production of this show. Today's program was produced by Akua Holt, Paulina Vasiliev, and Steve Zeltzer, who are the executive producers of this show. You can find this and all previous episodes at our website, covidtaskforce.pacifica.org. Make sure you click the subscribe button. You can follow us on Twitter at PacificaCRD and on Facebook at COVID, Race, and Democracy. I've been your host, Akua Holt. Thanks for listening. I leave you with this quote. We can disagree and still love each other unless your disagreement is rooted in my oppression and denial of my humanity and right to exist. James Baldwin.